Mark Honigsbaum is a medical historian, journalist, and author of 5 books, including the newest, The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. In the book, he narrates the last century of scientific struggle against the enemy we face today, deadly contagious disease. He would argue that our current crisis is representative of the cycle of neglect that has characterized a response to epidemics and pandemics over the last century. Today's situation contains uncanny parallels with 1918's influenza, not least in the virus's stealthy, silent spread around the world before erupting suddenly in multiple urban centers at the same time. The new book is The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Honigsbaum to the roundtable this morning. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Yes, thank you for inviting me. I'm very glad to speak to you.
It is a great pleasure. Obviously, you've been at work on this book a long time before COVID-19 became something that we are now all too familiar with. What sense do you have of in working on this book of how much we as a people should have seen this coming?
Well, I there were plenty of people warning us. There were plenty of people who, I mean, obviously nobody saw exactly this thing coming. But, you know, 2 years ago, the World Health Organization placed a new disease on its priority list of pathogens that might cause a pandemic, and they called it Disease X. And what that designated was the realization that there were a lot of pathogens out there that had the potential to cause a major global pandemic crisis, and we couldn't keep an eye on all of them or even necessarily predict which of the many potential pathogens might be the one that would make this leap into human populations in a way that allowed it to spread, as you said, stealthily and kind of almost insidiously under the radar.
In looking at how this is alike and how this is different from other pandemics, talk a little bit about that, about what we actually know about this particular pandemic and how it is similar and different from pandemics of the past.
Well, yes. So, I mean, no two pandemics are exactly alike. You know, so if we think of the largest pandemic, previous pandemic to this one, that would be HIV/AIDS. Of course, the major difference between HIV and COVID is that initially, at least, it targeted a very specific demographic, men who had sex with men, intravenous drug users, and hemophiliacs who were contaminated through the blood supply. But, of course, in Africa, it affected a much wider range of people, socioeconomic groups, men and women. And, you know, HIV was a slow burn. The HIV/AIDS pandemic is still with us. But, you know, HIV/AIDS had major cultural impacts. If we think more recently, there was a pandemic of swine influenza, if you remember that, in 2009, which initially caused a very similar kind of panic to the COVID one. But, of course, swine flu didn't turn out to be nearly as severe as people had feared. The projections for the number of deaths were way out of line with what actually happened. And that kind of engendered quite a lot of skepticism about, you know, so-called experts and their analyses. But really, COVID does most closely resemble, I think, the Spanish influenza. Of course, it's occurring in a very different historical period. In 1918, the world was at war. And because of that, in an odd way, the Spanish influenza, although it killed, you know, between 50 and 100 million people worldwide, in the United States, it killed 675,000 Americans, and that's when the population was about half the size it is today. It didn't have the dramatic impact, though, because the war overshadowed everything. And also, it wasn't really possible to halt the economy and impose the sort of drastic social distancing measures we're seeing today.
You write about the Spanish flu in the first chapter of your book and saying that most physicians assumed it would behave in a similar way to previous flu epidemics and dismissed it as a nuisance. You write in your prologue, while medical microbiology and the allied sciences of epidemiology, parasitology, zoology, and more recently molecular biology provide new ways of understanding the transmission and spread of novel pathogens and making them visible to clinicians, all too often these sciences and technologies have been found wanting. This is not simply because, as is sometimes argued, microbes are constantly mutating and evolving, outstripping our ability to keep pace with their shifting genetics and transmission patterns. It is also because of the tendency of medical researchers to become prisoners of particular paradigms and theories of disease causation, blinding them to the threats posed by pathogens best known and unknown. I'm interested if you could tell us a little bit about how that was the case with the influenza in 1918 and also what we're seeing today.
Yes. Okay. So thanks for reading that passage. Obviously, it's quite complex, probably, and technical for most of your readers to follow. The simplest example is in 1918, the received wisdom among bacteriologists, as they were known at that period, was that influenza was caused by a bacterium that had been isolated during the previous 1890 Russian influenza pandemic in Berlin by an associate of Robert Koch, the German bacteriologist. It was known as Pfeiffer's bacillus. So basically what this was is that when people developed flu, they took washings from their throat, and then they cultured those washings on agar plates, culture mediums in a laboratory, and then looked through a microscope, and they saw all these colonies of bacteria. And with influenza, they isolated what we now know today to be Haemophili influenzae, which is a very common bacteria found in the nose and throat. We know today that it actually causes infections like Hib meningitis. It doesn't cause flu, though. It's just a fellow traveler of all the, which goes along with flu and any infection of the respiratory system. So this led a lot of people down the wrong path. There were some scientists who began to suspect that influenza might be a filter passer, or what they called, some people called the virus. But in that stage, we didn't really have the technology to understand virus. We didn't have microscopes powerful enough to even visualize them. And we didn't, influenza, unlike other viral diseases that had been grown in animal bodies, there was no animal that we were able to culture influenza virus in. So people really didn't have a proper understanding of it. But more importantly, people were familiar with influenza, of course. Influenza comes along every season. And except for doctors who remembered the previous 1890 Russian influenza pandemic and realized that influenza had this sort of double face, it could be this mild disease, they were the only doctors who realized it also occasionally took on this plague-like connotations. So that meant that when people first saw these cases, they thought, oh, well, it's just influenza. It's only influenza was the sort of phrase that was used. People were much more concerned about other diseases like measles or community-acquired pneumonia. And it was only really in the second wave hit in the fall of 1918, and especially in large U.S. Army camps up and down the East Coast and the southern United States, where hundreds, thousands of men were sickened and developed these very severe pneumonias and forms of respiratory distress, that the veils lifted from scientists and health experts' eyes, and they said, this is a plague. This is not like the influenza, the familiar kind of old man's friend type influenza that we've seen in the past.
You say in the book that to judge by the recent run of pandemics and epidemics, the process seems to be speeding up And you say that if HIV and SARS were wake-up calls, then Ebola and Zika confirmed it. I'm curious as to how much of that is because of urbanization and globalization, and how much goes well beyond that.
It's really to do with a kind of critical confluence of factors that really have been brought home, I think, very sharply by the coronavirus outbreak. So I've been in the process of updating my book with a new chapter on COVID, and I've been speaking in more depth to virologists and disease ecologists, veterinary ecologists, whose business it is to venture into, for instance, caves in southern China where bats roost who harbor coronaviruses, but also other viruses that we've yet to emerge into human populations. And the data they've been collecting, they've basically compiled a map of global hotspots. And what really emerges from these maps is that because of factors like climate change, but also, as you point out, urbanization, and another very important factor is the way that the demand, growing demand for animal protein and meat in fast industrializing regions of the world, particularly in Asia, Southeast Asia, are really putting intense pressure on animal habitats that were previously remote and protected from, modern life, from our industrialized way of living. What this means is that as rainforests are cut down, or as people are forced to farm closer to the edges of those forests, the opportunities for people to be infected by bats that might harbor coronavirus or Ebola virus, or for some other domestic animal like a pig or a duck or a chicken to pick up either coronavirus or a form of avian influenza, increases, okay? And this is what's happening. So we're creating more and more opportunities for these viruses to spill over. And then once they do spill over, the connections that these places are no longer so remote. You know, there are now roads almost everywhere. Wuhan was a major domestic and international hub with over 100 direct flights to 70 countries worldwide. That was not the case 10 years ago.
You have the word hubris in the subtitle of the book, and I'd like to just close with that, in the sense that in my reading of your book, it seems, not all the time, but in many cases, we simply didn't learn our lessons. And I'm wondering what you see as this current pandemic unfolds, if we will learn lessons this time.
Okay, so yeah, I need to be clear about this. I definitely think that when Ebola happened in 2014 in West Africa, there were many scientists and experts who thought, well, it's just Ebola, like all the other Ebola outbreaks we've seen in Central Africa, which have been confined largely to remote forested regions. They didn't think Ebola was capable of reaching a major urban center, much less sparking a region-wide epidemic. What we learned then was that we needed a massive response to close Ebola down. It could have become a pandemic. It didn't. After that, the World Health Organization recognized us by having this category disease X. So I think that you can't accuse the World Health Organization for complacency. And there are lots of other experts like Bill Gates who were running pandemic exercises warning us, you know, that the big one was coming. I think that though the politicians have been very, very slow. And I think really that's where the complacency lies today. After all, think about it. Even after we saw in January those astounding and horrific pictures from China of, people clamoring for access to hospital emergency wards, the Chinese raising hospitals overnight, constructing these huge waiting rooms, we still then waited until just really in March to actually lay contingency plans. You know, we should have been testing much earlier. We should have been ordering extra PPE and masks and ventilators back in January. But we didn't, because we thought somehow that we were superior, that our health service systems were better. And I think we've got a very, very stark and brutal lesson in hubris right there, right now.
Mark Honigsbaum's book is called The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. He's a medical historian, journalist, and author, and the book is published by Norton. Mark, thank you very much for spending your time with us. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Pandemic Century by Mark Honigsbaum. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.